emotions are still there when people who experienced the Exxon Valdez oil spill start talking about it. Is it your turn? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. There's pain, worry, and despair in those memories, but some have every reason to be proud of how they rose to the occasion. Our number is 1-800-478-8255, toll-free, 478-TALK. In Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422. Email talk@aprn.org. Is there somebody you saw who responded well to that huge challenge of 20 years ago? Tell us on Talk of Alaska, statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Support for APRN coverage of Iditarod 2009 comes from Spinard Builders, supplying Devo paints, adding color and life to your home.
Well, I wasn't there. As a matter of fact, I was in Alaska, and I got a phone call, and they said, this might be the big one. And I said, well, it's Saturday. We don't have a newscast today. We don't have a newscast till Monday, so don't worry about it. And that was it. We didn't really do anything until later in the weekend. I was on an airplane and going to Valdez. My memories are very, very vivid, even these many years later, of this event. I mean, I suppose they have flashes, and I'm sure there's some gaps in there, but they are very, very vivid. I have asked some others who have direct experience of the spill to join us for this show today, and then we'll go back again next week, which is the actual anniversary, and look more at the policy part of it. But I thought for this first program, it would be good to actually just simply hang out together and share some memories, because I saw people perform, on the whole, very well. I saw conduct that I thought qualifies as being heroic over and over and over again as Alaskans and others responded to the spill. And I think that needs to be underscored because it was such a scary thing and such a big thing and something that was going to be a disaster and a tragedy and an environmental monstrosity. And so how did people respond to the challenge? People you know. Maybe there's somebody you want to single out, something they did that you would like to share with the people of Alaska from low those 20 years ago. And then bearing in mind there are people listening to this program right now that weren't even alive when this thing happened. But Charles Woolforth was.
Indeed.
thanks for coming in today.
My pleasure.
Charles was working for the Anchorage Daily News at the time of the spill and was there for a good deal of the covering the response, and I'd like to get him to talk about that. He is author of Hidden Waters, Human Nature and the Fate of the Oceans, but you can't buy this book yet because it hasn't been published yet, right? But you can buy The Whale and the Supercomputer about climate warming. And now, Charles, we've turned your attention to marine conservation and tied it in with the oil spill.
Yeah. You know, the Exxon Valdez oil spill was a transformative event for a lot of people, and it was a transformative event for the state. And then also, it was probably the biggest environmental event in history in terms of people's consciousness of it. There was this huge survey that was done after the oil spill for the contingent valuation studies to figure out, you know, what impact did it have on people's perception of the value of Alaska. And over 90% of Americans knew all about it and had, you know, to some level, the traumatic memories of it, as compared to less than 80% knew who the vice president was. So Dan Quayle, by the way. that guy. But, I mean, it just shows there's been no environmental event that has been larger in terms of a single event focusing people's attention. And I think one of the big questions is what do we make of that? Where did we take that? Did we get any good out of it? And you know, how do we deal with those memories from here? Not just let them fade away, or is there something valuable to be gained?
Wow, that's a meditation, really.
Yeah,
I could see how you can get a book out of something like that.
Right. Well, the book isn't just about the oil spill, but, you know, the Prince William Sound and Gulf of Alaska area are a really rich area in terms of the history of conservation and the history of mankind's relationship to the oceans. And the big question of, you know, what do we do as a species to cooperate the way we need to save the oceans? And the Exxon Valdez oil spill is this incredible example of how not to do it, because it's an example of how we set up a political and legal system that failed us right down the line, failed us in prevention, failed us in response, and failed us in terms of justice after the fact. So we know what doesn't work. You know, how do we figure out what does work, and what kinds of, you know, human relationships we can create that are going to protect the ocean?
One thing that you were underscoring, even as we sat down for the program, is the notion of broken promises. And I wonder if you can kind of take yourself back to that, the days after the spill, and some of the promises that might have been made right there. The most famous one, of course, is Don Cornette standing up, and I was there in Cordova, and saying, "We will make you whole."
That's right. You know, one of the things that people noticed about the spill, and you were there in Valdez, and APRN was one of the heroes in terms of putting all those press conferences on the air so everybody in Alaska knew exactly what was going on, unfiltered. But what happened was you got into this weird space between reality and perception and projection of what was happening. And so there are the broken promises before the fact, but then there were also sort of the broken promise of just telling the truth and what was really going on. I remember Frank Irasi, who was the president of Exxon Shipping Company, as a little bit of a hero. I mean, he was the guy who really was largely responsible, right, because he was in charge of the company. But when he showed up in Valdez, he told the truth. In those first 3 days, and I've got it in my notes, which I still have, where he says, "Hey, we just got here. We don't know what we're doing. I've never dealt with an oil spill before. I don't know how to do this. We're hopeful that in a few days we may be up and running." And by that time, of course, it was too late. So I think there were legal promises, and there were strong implicit promises that they knew what the heck they were doing. And then here was a guy who came and pretty much said, you know, "We don't." And then that was proved out over and over again over the weeks and months that followed.
Well, one thing that became apparent to me quickly, and I'm sure to you as well, is that the president at that time, George H.W. Bush, really didn't say anything. He didn't respond at the beginning at all. Sometime later, he sent his transportation secretary to take a look at it, Mr. Skinner, I believe it was, and he flew around and took a look at it and acted like he was really taking charge. But the real point people for the Bush administration were the NOAA people that came in. And that crew was set up in one hotel, and the Department of Environmental Conservation set up in some office building. And they were flying competing reconnaissance flights as to where the oil was. And the NOAA people talked a good game, but boy, I'm telling you, the mask came off by the time Jerry Gault arrived in Kodiak and announced, "This oil doesn't sink."
Yeah.
The oil was already there. And they were trying to say, well, it's never going to get outside the sound. And
right.
The oil was already at the Kodiak archipelago.
Yeah, this was one of the weird things about it, is that that so many people did not understand what we were dealing with in terms of its magnitude and what it was going to mean. And then there were a few who did, who tended to be Cassandras, who would make these predictions that nobody would pay any attention to. And you've jogged two very vivid memories for me. One is the day that Secretary Skinner and Bill Riley, the head of the EPA, came into town, and I managed to sneak my way into their helicopter and fly out with them. And the helicopter was too noisy. They couldn't hear each other. So I handed them a notebook, and they passed notes back and forth in my reporter's notebook. And the note that I remember the most clearly was head of the EPA handing a note to the head of the Coast Guard saying, "If cleanup is ongoing, where is it?" Because we were looking down on Prince William Sound, and we could see oil as far as the eye could see, and we couldn't see any vessels at all. We couldn't see anything happening at all. And I think it was just like a white-faced shock as these guys got off the helicopter and sequestered themselves. They wouldn't talk to the media. They wouldn't talk to anybody because this was their, oh my God, moment. You know, this thing is completely out of control and we have no hope of dealing with it. And everything that's been said up to now about it being dealt with is fiction. And yet there were some people, I remember Jackie Michelle and who was a contractor with NOAA, Dave Kennedy, who was with NOAA Hazmat, and they were saying, well, they predicted, and I've also got this in my notes, week by week, month by month, what was going to happen. And they said, this oil is going to be there 10 years from now. It may be there 20 years from now. And it turned out that they were right about that, and yet, you know, really no one paid any attention to those predictions.
Yeah, I remember that too. I remember also that Jerry Galt said, well, it'll mostly kind of turn into this asphalty stuff. That turned out not to be true.
That's right. Yeah. No one knew what was going to happen. And that's kind of one of the mysteries of this whole thing about why they didn't know what was going to happen. You know, why they didn't have better knowledge, why they didn't have better preparation. And, you know, I think a lot of our politicians who were big-time boomers and big-time development, pro-development people were also shocked. And for a little while, they weren't so boomer and they weren't so pro-development anymore. They really recognized the vulnerability of the environment, and there was a much more environmental conscious Alaska for a few years.
Yeah. Boy, you're jogging a lot of my memories, and pretty soon we'll be going. So let's get a few calls in here. But I do want to say before we start on this that I deliberately selected guests for this program who I thought acted commendably, and you are one of them because you chose to sustain your coverage. I mean, we saw the parachute media basically in and out in about a week and a half, but you stayed there what? For almost a year you were in and out.
Yeah, well, I actually lived in an apartment in Valdez for that entire summer into September, and then I kept covering the story for the next year as my primary assignment. So I covered it pretty much all the way through. I mean, I can't accept any heroism. It's the biggest story that I'll ever cover and a transformative story, and anybody who wouldn't have grabbed that opportunity as a reporter would be an idiot. So, you know, in a way, it was a huge opportunity for me career-wise, and in a way, it was also a very traumatic and tough experience.
Well, it's just, it's in the nature of cowboying up. Nancy Lethkoe told me when I, and she'll be on this show later, she says, you know, I used to worry about him so much in that little boat of his.
Yeah, that's right. We had a little boat, little Boston Whaler. We ran around in with the Daily News photographers. It's quite exciting. Fortunately, I was in my mid-20s, so it was a little bit easier than it would be now.
Well, let's go to our first caller who is in Anchorage but was in Homer, I understand, at the time of the spill. Lauren, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi. Actually, I lived in Homer for 17 years, but when the spill happened, I was actually out of Kodiak as a commercial fisherwoman, and I had only been fishing as a deckhand the year before the oil spill, but I fished both the winter and the summer. And then I was on a boat that you might recall that has since met its demise in the Bering Sea called the Big Valley. And I was in Florida when the spill happened, and I called my skipper on the Big Valley, and they said, you know, we need you to come back up. So I went back up, and I was there on day 3 or 4 of the oil spill. And our job was to give water and fuel and supplies to any of the support vessels that needed it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went right up to the Exxon Valdez to the dive boat that had the welders. And I just can remember it was like real, and, you know, it was just very intimidating in a way to see this huge vessel, but at the same time, very sad to see it broken and spilling out all the oil. And then I had gone all over Prince William Sound on that boat.
Now, let me interrupt you for a second. Was this when it was at Naked Island, had been moved, or was it before?
No, on the reef.
Oh, my.
Because they had to weld it a little before they can move it. And, you know, and so it was really, I thought, you know, when it first started, and I'm like thinking, man, there's just not enough boats out here. And this is a really big spill. And my only other experience in Prince William Sound prior to being there during the oil spill, because all my fishing experience had been in Kodiak or the Bering Sea or Ketchumet Bay, I had kayaked for a month in Prince William Sound in 1981. So to come back and to see it the way it was quite a shock. And then after working on the oil spill in Prince William Sound, I actually quit that job in June because I had a salmon seining job waiting for me in Kodiak. I went to Kodiak not knowing they were going to cancel the fishing season there, and sat around with thousands of other deckhands just sitting around because we were told by Exxon and Crawford Insurance, which was kind of running the show there administratively, they said that if we went out looking for oil spill work, then we wouldn't be allowed to file a claim as deckhands.
Oh, boy.
And so then we sat around for a month, and they finally closed the fishery permanently. And then we were told another story that we could go work anywhere we could find a job. Well, by then it was pretty late in the summer, and I was fortunate to get a job working in Kodiak on a boat picking up oiled beach gravel from set netters on the north end of Kodiak.
Wow. So it sounds like...
I saw a lot of different perspectives, and I want to say that the heroes to me were the fishermen, and what I liked about the oil spill is that it gave fishermen, I think fishermen had a kind of a bad rap at times, that they didn't care about marine mammals and they didn't like them getting in their nets. But I never saw so many fishermen so upset by all the marine mammals and birds that were killed than any other group out there.
Yeah, I think, I think that there's a really good point there, and I really felt the same way about fishermen who felt that they were seeing their livelihoods disappear, and many did lose their livelihoods. The other thing, though, that just being totally honest here, is that the oil spill brought out heroes, and it also brought out the worst in people. And I remember some of those Kodiak fishermen that you're talking about, that the claims process was determined that Exxon was going to pay the skippers and they were going to pay the deckhands. And then the deckhands didn't get a penny because the skippers kept the money. And so there was this, and that was another thing that created all this conflict and division in the communities, heavy conflict in every fishing community between those who got and those who didn't get, those who got huge amounts, those who got nothing, destroyed relationships and destroyed lives in terms of people who couldn't deal with the psychological damage of that. So there's the heroes, and there's also that it brought out the worst in people at the same time, and is just another reason you never want it to happen again. And I, as you were talking, and I was hearing the emotion in your voice, I have had the opportunity to interview a lot of oil spill veterans in the last year, and time again, I hear something that sounds like talking to a war veteran. You know, they say, I saw a piece of boom and I just started crying, and it's 20 years ago and I can't believe I still feel that way. And you just hear people talking about these emotions flooding out that are still so raw. And I think that's something that people who weren't there probably would have a hard time understanding.
Yeah, because, it was a beautiful natural environment, and to see all the death in that environment. And I think that was the hardest part, because I had been on another boat that had thousands of seabirds in the hold. And then picking up the bags of dead marine, you know, otters. And it was like we never really got to process it afterwards. And it will always be an emotional thing. And one other thing I want to point out is that I thought never really came to light very much is that a lot of the deckhands not only had that happen to them about the money from the skippers, but also we lost out on a whole season of experience. And that experience, excuse me, that experience, one summer on a boat, it's not just a summer. It's like equals a whole year at another job experience. And we didn't get that. I lost out on that, even though I went out and worked on the oil spill.
Yeah. But I lost out. You didn't. You also, it sounds like you did not really become a, I mean, you didn't really benefit that much from the money that was being thrown around. You didn't become a spillionaire, as they later would call them.
No, but I will say my skipper, Wayne Russell,
yeah,
he did give us each our 10% of what he got. For there was the initial little payout to the fishermen in Kodiak that tied him over.
Mm-hmm. Good right. for him.
Thank you. Thank you, Lauren. Thanks for sharing those memories. Let's go now to Clay, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. Oh, we lost Clay. Let's dip up one there to line five and Terry. Terry, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yes, hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very good. Yeah, I was one of the first dozen boats hired out there on the oil spill, and my experiences were how ill-prepared they were for what was going on there.
Well, I guess, I understand it, at least from my reading of the reports, there was no place to put any oil that was recovered because the barge didn't have a bulkhead in it, and the Coast Guard wouldn't let it leave the port for the oil to be put in it until one was welded in there, and they didn't have the right kind of welders around. So this took quite a while, just that part. There was no place to put any oil you recovered.
Well, first they had to dig all the equipment out of the snow.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, and the skimmers that were designed, well, the viscosity of the oil was so thick by the time they picked it up that the pumps couldn't pump it out, so they were sidelined and ineffective. I was with another boat towing an inflator boom, and it's got a small compressor on it that keeps the boom inflated, and the wind came up, and we had to drop the boom and tow one end of it back into the anchorage while it started sinking on us, and it turned out that the compressor had run out of gas. This is supposed to go for like 3 days, and it went for about 12 hours. So they didn't even bother refueling their oil spill response gear after the oil spill that they had at the terminal. I think it was in February. It was a pretty lame operation.
You know,
and
one of the things,
a great opportunity there in that KCHU public radio had just come online. And they were broadcasting all the press conferences at the Civic Center here in Valdez, and we were able to listen to them out there on the spill site. And the contrast between what was actually happening and what they were stating was happening on the press conferences, it was just a laughing joke.
Yeah, I remember Dave Hammack doing those broadcasts, and I had the same experience running out in a boat, finding out what reality was, coming back and telling everybody, and it was weird. One of the things that your comment reminds me of, though, is that there was this sense that, well, technology caused this accident. Well, technology can fix it. If we just throw a little bit more technology at it, it's going to be fixed. A little bit more effort, and it's going to be fixed. And it slowly dawned on you that there's no technology that exists or will ever exist to clean up an 11 million gallon oil spill or 30 million gallons or whatever it really was that spreads over 1,000 miles of beaches. The world is too big, and you're not going to invent that kind of technology. And something that brought it home really well was when Tom Copeland from CDFU went out, and he went out with his crew with flour scoops and 5 gallon buckets. And where the skimmers were unable to do anything, he would fill up his boat with oil by scooping it out of the water with flour scoops. And then he would just instead of worrying about somebody accepting these buckets, he'd just pull up alongside a garbage boat, put the buckets on it, and take off. So they wouldn't even know where the things came from. And he was cleaning up way more oil than the most effective skimmer they had out there. So total failure of technology, inability of people to recognize and accept that.
Terry, I want to...
Looking at it in conclusion, though, I think the best way for them to have dealt with that oil spill would have been a fire boom, and we had the perfect opportunity, a light breeze drifting to the south. They did one test burn out there, and I think it was fairly successful, but...
I've looked at that, and
people put the kibosh on that, and that's a shame, because that would have...
Well, if we had Martha Vlasov here, she would bristle right now because she was in Tetlik at the time. And
I've looked at that recently.
I was out there anchored off a reef island at the time of that fire boom, and everything drifted to the south. I do not understand how she could have gotten any fumes from that burn.
Yeah,
I witnessed the whole thing. I was anchored right there 5 miles north of it.
Thank you, Terry.
I think they could have got more oil with fire, but I've researched that recently. And in fact, even in the best circumstances, you get a very small minority of the oil with fire because you can't concentrate it enough. It has to be highly concentrated in order to burn. And the spill was already too big. So they would have gotten a small percentage, even if they had used that successfully. But I mean, they could have used it more than they did.
And the tactic is routinely used in large marine spills nowadays in saltwater off the coast of Africa. That's how they deal with them, and they still have them there. This one from Anne. I was 9 when EVOS happened. This is an email response, and it's talk@APRN.org. I was 9 when EVOS happened. I remember it clearly. My family helped make booms for the cleanup. I'll always be thankful for the many workers who cleaned birds and beaches during that awful time. I'll never forget it. It's made me distrustful of big corporations and yearn for a more just judiciary.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, I'm sure there are plenty more like that.
I was on a research cruise summer before last, and the principal investigator, senior scientist on this research cruise, seemed kind of young to me. So I said, well, where were you during the oil spill? And she said, well, I was in middle school. I wrote a report on it for my science class.
Wow.
So that's how long ago it was, and that's actually how much, you know, it's become a science industry that we got people who go through high school, go through college, get their PhDs, become senior scientists, and they can start studying it, and all since it happened.
Well, yeah, and actually, you know, as you tie that knot to back into the original theme of what your new book is about, Charles Woolforth, and by golly, it ties fairly neatly because it turns out that when Wally Hickel settled, the state and federal government got all this money, which they put a hunk of it into science, and that those scientists are now working the Bering Sea marine conservation issue. You know, we're using the Dickham Sands money instead of the Exxon Valdez money. Same scientists, pretty much. And they're doing breakthrough ecosystem studies that they learned how to do in Prince William Sound.
One of my things that I became aware of in working on this book is I went back and looked at a lot of the science, and there was some groundbreaking world-class science that was done and some important findings that were made. Jeep Rice from NOAA was particularly one of the important ones. But there was also an enormous amount of waste in the science program. We ended up spending about half of the $1 billion, about $500 million on science. And if you go back and look at it, a huge amount of it is of no value or a very limited value. One reason is because of the secrecy during the litigation. It was ill-planned. There was no overall system for making sure the data would be interoperable for future projects. And then there was also, I think, a tendency in the agencies just to feather their own nest and do whatever projects that they would have been doing anyway. So I think that there's really room for a major study to be done looking at the whole science program and saying, hey, if this ever happens again, God forbid, something bad is going to happen. How do we design a science program where we don't spend $500 million, half of all the money we got, and come out with so little? How do we design a program that would actually tell us something new? Because if you go to the scientists now and say, well, how does the Prince William Sound ecosystem work? They can't tell you. They're still doing basic studies.
Yeah, I would put a big fat ditto on that. And we will go into that also in the next week's show. Greg Erickson is going to be on here, and he was in charge of the damage assessment that the state was doing at the time. So that should be fun. One of Greg's many portfolios.
That's right.
It's Talk of Alaska. The subject, as you may have gathered, is the Exxon Valdez oil spill. We're especially asking people to look back into their living memories of this event for stories that haven't been told about people who responded, who really responded with the best in themselves to this spill, because there certainly were – it was such a huge strain, and I saw many, many people – really go into their deep reserves and pull out some very, very strong actions. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Learn more at rasmussen.org.
It's Talk of Alaska. The subject, answering the challenge of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. And we're bringing up memories from 20 years ago, just as if it was yesterday. I have Charles Woolforth with me in the studio. He's the author of a book that's not out yet called Hidden Waters, Human Nature and the Fate of the Oceans. And I think, do we have Nancy on the line now? Great. We're going to go now to Valdez and another person who was there. In fact, the author of The Cruising Guide to Prince William Sound, Nancy Lefko of Valdez. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Nancy.
Hi, Steve. Nice to be here. Tough topic.
It's an extremely tough topic, and I think we all realize it. And I'm wanted to have you on, Nancy, because of the way that I saw you respond, which was to I would not learn until some years later that your educational background was Buddhist studies, and I think you managed to quiet some inner demons enough to be effective after the spill. What I always remember, and I don't remember exactly how this was that there was this unified command, but that it needed advisors to give them the local knowledge, and you, as the co-author of The Cruising Guide, were obviously one of those people that could help them, and you immediately just rolled up your sleeves and pitched right in. Do I have that right? How did that work?
Yes. I guess, everyone remembers how they first heard, and Matt Kenny, here in Valdez, gave us a call at about 4:30 in the morning and said, you should turn on your VHF radio. There's been, I think, a big spill. And so, we reached up in the boat and turned the VHF radio on, and pretty soon we're aware that this is not a hoax, but actually something real. And Jim and I realized immediately that people did not know much about the sound, and that the DEC office had only two people, and we were going to be inundated with people. So I went up to the DEC office, and for the first couple of days, just marked on maps for people out in the sound where people were living where various resources were, cleaned out the garbage, brought in the donuts, suggested that maybe people try and get something better than donuts and coffee. After the second or third day of response, people were working 24 hours a day trying to to get a response going. And out of that, they started setting up some committees, and I was asked to serve on a committee that Noah and the Coast Guard led. And I think we've been in the discussion overlooking the really important role that the Coast Guard did play. I hate to say the number of meetings I sat in to and heard very frustrated Coast Guard admirals saying, I've always heard the criticism that the government can't do a good job, but Exxon's doing no job. And I would really like to see big business step up and do the job they're supposed to be doing. Very frustrated government people with the response that was going on. And all of it, we were just... It was important to focus not on the past, not on the future, but I felt on the moment and what needed to be done in that moment, and then what I could do to help in that moment.
Yeah, and it as you said, you would get the donuts or whatever was there to be done. You also, when the wind blew up there after a couple of days, and all of a sudden the oil was all the way across the sound, you were probably as knowledgeable as anybody about where they ought to be looking for it and where it was going to pool up and so forth.
Yeah, we knew something about the currents at various places. We talked to Dave Kennedy about some of the local knowledge we had that helped them to get an idea of where the oil was most likely going to go, where to look for it, and did their aerial surveys.
Well, Nancy, I want to...
I can tell there's funny things, and I think people should remember the funny things, too, because that's the only way it's to sort of cope with things. And I was up helping Exxon put things on the map of where people were living or where the fish hatcheries were or et cetera. And suddenly somebody comes in and says, the Coast Guard needs you, and they pick me up, and they pick Jim up, and we go down to the harbor, and there's this big ship there, and we're taken on board, and we're taken up to the bridge, and the navigator and captain are there, and then we've written the cruising guide on Prince William Sound. So they want to know where to anchor a 600-foot ship.
Whoa. Yeah, well, you don't have too much.
I could remember the last time we had done that.
Yeah, that's right.
So we started asking them how much anchor line, how many anchors they had, what their road was, what their system was. They had less than we had. They were used to tying up to buoys.
Oh, my gosh.
Or docks.
And these are fjords.
To get the anchoring gear.
Oh my God, yeah, because these are fjords. These are really deep.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, Nancy's comment about the Coast Guard brought to mind a comment I want to make, which is through all of this, I don't think I've ever met any bad people. You know, I never met any people who had bad intent. And that goes for Exxon, that goes for Vico, that goes for everybody involved. You know, Joe Hazelwood had a disease of alcoholism. You know, the people who drove the ship actually on the rocks didn't have the proper training. You know, they didn't know what they were doing, and they'd been put in an impossible position. The people who were running the vessel traffic system, the guy who was actually looking at the scopes didn't know how to operate it correctly. He didn't know how to change the scale so that he could see where the ship was. The reason for that was because the Coast Guard, not bad people, but their staffing had been cut, so they didn't have time for proper training and oversight of the guy operating the radar. You know, so you look at a guy like Steve McCall, who was the commander of the port there, a wonderful guy, and had the best heart in the world. But the fact is that, you know, the Coast Guard failed. They had the equipment to see where that ship was and get it out of danger. But from an institutional perspective, the money hadn't been put in to make that system work. The ship, they had the mariners on the ship who could run the ship, but Exxon had cut the staffing to the point where they couldn't get qualified people on the deck to make the ship work. You know, from the point of view of the double hull tankers, you know, the promise was made that there would be double hull tankers, but when it actually came down to it, the institution failed. The federal government did not follow through, and so we didn't have double hull tankers. So it wasn't that there were bad individuals that caused this, and that's what we need to think about is, It was caused by these institutions that failed us, and good people in bad institutions are not going to be able to prevent disasters.
I guess I disagree with that. I don't know if this is the time or place, but I think before this bill, the Coast Guard, particularly Steve McCall, really felt strongly that it was silly to have pilots on the boats, the ships coming in or leaving, and that the whole Valdez operation probably should be cut back, phased down. He was not opposed to it. There was, as you know,
Nancy, as I recall, it was at first. Didn't they have to? They had to have a pilot all the way out to Hinchinbrook.
And then they decided that that was too dangerous and too expensive, and so they cut it back.
Your perception is that the commander would just thought the whole thing really was unnecessary.
I think the general attitude, probably from the commander, I think from our congressional delegation, I think from our state government, I think from the Bush administration, we're all responding to the oil industry that, you know, we've got to watch our bottom line here.
Okay, well, we agree then, because I think you're right about that. What I'm trying to say is, don't try to blame it on individual person. Blame it on the way we set up this system so that we set it up right the next time. And whatever McCall's views were, they did cut the budget a lot in that Valdez office and therefore didn't have the people to run it. So, I mean, I get unhappy when I see people trying to scapegoat or blame individuals when what we've got is a sick system of government where these corporations are able to get what they want, you know, and that's what happened.
Yeah. Well, I don't know, from my point of view as a media person, I feel that we failed. I mean, we didn't even know there was a new contingency plan. I mean, why? Because we weren't watching. We didn't bother to watch. So we were kind of being lulled. Well, there's no real news here. And meanwhile, the news was happening in slow steps. The whole regulatory framework was eroding without us ever reporting on it. Tony Bickert reported on it a little bit from time to time.
Also in the environmental community, because I would say to environmentalists in Anchorage and other places, say, look, we've got some serious problems down here in Valdez that are potential to become much worse with these two oil spills, with the fact that they were giving permission for loaded tankers to go inside Rocky Point, to let off pilots because they thought it was too rough a seas rather than taking them all the way to Seattle. And trying to get even the requirement of a pilot on board to be discontinued. And the reaction I got from the environmental community is, you down there in Valdez wanted the oil, so you can put up with it.
Oh, boy.
You got to solve those problems.
Yeah.
It was statewide and pervasive in all of our thinking.
Yeah. Nancy Lethgo is with us, the author of Cruising Guide to Prince William Sound, the co-author, I think I should say, and Charles Wolforth, who is author of a forthcoming book, but also wrote The Whale and the Supercomputer, which some listeners are probably familiar with, and covered the oil spill aftermath for the Anchorage Daily News. He was able to stay there for the better part of the year to follow that. And I'm sure many times you were all by yourself on that story, Charles.
Yeah, that was a really weird thing to be covering a $2 billion cleanup operation and have all the national media leave. And essentially it would be me and maybe somebody from the Anchorage Times who was basically stringing and maybe somebody from the Valdez newspaper. And professionally it ended up, you know, so many people had this experience where good things mixed with bad. But I ended up writing for the biggest newspapers and magazines in the country because they had nobody there. And that's what started the freelance writing career that I'm still in today.
This is illustrative of the point, Charles, that you were making earlier and that you're making in your book, that There's really not been another environmental experience in the United States to match the Exxon Valdez in terms of the shockwaves that ran through the entire populace. Check this one out. It comes from, I can't get the name. I was living in Las Cruces, New Mexico, when the Exxon Valdez went aground. Among my memories, beside the horror of realization what was happening in my home state, was the group of Alaskans that suddenly found each other at NMSU, and the tears that flowed because of the hurt that was happening to the land, animals, and people. These Alaskans someplace else.
Yeah.
We glued ourselves to any piece of news that we could find to keep abreast of the happenings. All of us felt so helpless because we couldn't do anything to help with the cleanup or anything. Nancy Lethko, you cruised Prince William Sound before the spill. You and Jim wrote that book. You're now hoping to get out the latest, with new charts and everything, edition of it. And hopefully you have that out in time for cruising season this year. I wish you the best. I'm so glad that you took the time out to talk with us, because I know you're very busy with that task. But I recall sailing with you after the spill, and you said, you know, it's just, I can't describe to you, but for those of us who knew it before, it's simply not the same place. The abundance is different.
Well, Disk Harbor is a beautiful little harbor in the Night Island group. It's a very narrow entrance that one eases one way carefully into this lovely bay inside. And every time we would go in there, there was a belted kingfisher that always perched on a branch out. And we just always looked for the belted kingfisher and knew that he would fly off, or if we didn't see him there, we'd see him shortly feeding around the edges of Disk Bay. And gone. All those animals that we knew sort of personally from the times we had been to Anchorage, just who was here, what they were doing, where they perch, they were gone. Gone. Mm. And yes, there are little things, but they're what give you a sense of belonging to a place and a feeling of fitting in and being part of it. And I just always think of that kingfisher. And then there are memories one carries that one tries very hard not to carry, and things one saw that and heard you prefer not to have seen and saw and heard. I got off the boat one morning to go up to help the DEC office, and they were bringing in a sea otter in a cage, and the sea otter was crying with its paws tearing its eyes out. That gave me nightmares for years.
You know, I remember the plane I came in on also had, actually it was very interesting who was on that plane, but Eric Gundlach was on there, and he is, as you will probably recall, the consultant who developed from an earlier spill in Europe the computer software that would allow you to build these maps of where you were siting the oil and what damage was being done to the ecosystem. So the state contracted with him, and I was on the same plane, same little plane flying into Valdez with him. And one memory I will always carry is because the radio station I was working at was right across from where the animal rehab center was, mm-hmm. which was in the school there, the mm-hmm. college, that Eric and a guy from DEC both carrying a sea otter into that place that they had picked up, and I remember Eric had been bit.
Yeah, that happened pretty frequently. Yeah.
Dangerous, too. But a question that came to me is, wouldn't it have been better? I mean, this is questions between science and compassion. I think it would have been better to euthanize those sea otters on the beach.
And no doubt about it.
That, rather than to bring them in. So many of them died. And I raised this question with people, and they said, well, they died, yes, but we learned more.
Nancy, and I followed up.
Science, learning more, and pain and suffering for an animal.
Yeah, well, right. I don't know how much they really did learn, because they still recognize that they can't save most sea otters. Sea otters are just an animal that if it's oiled, is going to be in bad shape. And I had a disturbing conversation with the Fish and Wildlife Service as I was researching my book. One of the scientists who was involved in all this and felt that, yes, on balance, the sea otter rescue probably did more harm than good, certainly in terms of suffering, possibly in terms of the number of animals affected, and said, I said, well, what are you going to do next time? He said, well, the contingency plan is to do the exact same thing.
Because the companies want the publicity of what they're doing positively.
Exactly. And to me, and if I mean, this may sound crazy, but I would like to see, you know, you can't punish a company, right? You can, it's like kicking a chair when you step over it, when you bump into it. You can't really punish a company, but you could take the people responsible and have them put down the otters, you know, have them do it on TV. You know, that would be the kind of thing that would have an impact.
Whoa, I think that's a point for a break as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP. Giving back to the community is a priority because so many at BP call Alaska home. And by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Oh, I just remembered that I didn't tell the office that we were going to do this show and that the phone system was going to be utterly disabled by all the incoming calls by this show. But I'm sure that's what's happening. My apologies to everybody in the shop here. But, you know, it's not too much longer and this show will be over and most of the calls we will not get to. And I thank you very much for your participation. Let's go to Harry, joins the program from Golovin. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Harry.
Well, good morning. I enjoy your show, Steve.
Thank you.
We're a fan way over here under utilizing KNSA radio. Several years ago, several of us leaders from Norton Sound villages here were invited by Exxon and the oil companies to view the oil platforms in the Cook Inlet region and also up into Inuvik, Canada, see their ice islands, and to see how safe their operations were. Well, that's fine, but my concern then at the time in the early 70s was immediate that the oil spill would be greater utilizing oil tankers. And it did happen. Now, there are several of us here in the Norton Sound region that joined the lawsuit against ExxonMobil. Yet no payments were made, although they were announced. But I talked to several of the people that joined the lawsuit. And to me, justice is blind or bought by Exxon. It's kind of heartening to see that such a big oil corporation will withhold payments.
Well, it's you could also call it due diligence. Harry, thank you for your call up there on the Norton Sound coast, and you should be seeing some dog mushers, and I think in there before too long. Harry, thanks for calling Talk of Alaska.
And could I say something? One thing that concerns me is that we have the RCAC in Valdez, Prince William Sound, the oil spill area. But when we're talking, you know, this, they haven't done anything preventive yet for the rest of the pipeline. When we're talking about a Trans-Alaska gas pipeline to Canada, I don't hear any talk about setting up a way for citizens to have input. And I think that's really one of the best things that came out of this bill was the RCAC, mm-hmm. and that needs to be standard procedure for any type of large operation this, where we could have a mega catastrophe that would affect so many people, lives, ability to go on living in an area, that, and of course the marine environment or land environment in which they are dependent.
Yep. Ditto on that.
Yeah, I'm thinking, too, that Opunnati was written right after the spill, and I think it's been watered down since. I think the kind of RCACs you would get now are not as good as the one that they have in Valdez. In a sense, it's
And you know, Rick Steiner, who was recently been in the news for having his funding cut, has been all over the world setting up RCAC-type organizations in Azerbaijan and Mongolia, and he's told me that he gets a much better reception, actually, in the former Soviet republics. They have much more people, person-to-person democracy there than we do in this country in terms of willingness to set up an RCAC organization and listen to what it has to say. And that's got to be held up as really the main positive thing that came from this bill, is this concept of citizen democracy, local people having control, which is long-term is the only solution, is the only way you're going to prevent these kinds of accidents, or at least reduce their frequency.
Let's go to Bruce, joins the program from Eagle River. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Bruce.
Yeah, hi, Steve. If you may recall, I worked with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as their spokesperson for a number of years.
Bruce Woods?
Bruce Batten.
Oh, Bruce!
Oh, hi.
Well, that's that. You are a blast from the past, Bruce.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I wanted to just point out a couple things about, in terms of lessons learned in this particular part of Alaska's history, and for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as a wildlife manager as well. And that was the huge importance to the American public of what we used to call charismatic megafauna, the sea otters in particular, birds as well. But the difference that I think the story had for people who were able to see the pictures of these sea otters, as you were discussing earlier, they were just so compelling and got people involved at a level that I think a lot of other environmental stories don't. News people, I'm sure you're familiar with the term, a story having legs. The fact that the spill happened in Prince William Sound, but the oil moved out into the Gulf of Alaska and as far as Kodiak and so forth, made it for a long story that was retold for weeks and weeks and months.
Yeah, it's true. Bruce, I'm going to have to let you go because we run out of time.
Great, great. Well, thanks for having the show. It's good to learn some lessons on this.
It is, and we'll be back again on the subject on the next Talk of Alaska. Nancy Lethko, I want to thank you for being with us today. I know you were reluctant. I know you got a book to get back to. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for what you're doing, and it was good hearing from people.
Yeah, it is. People had kind of forgotten, like Bruce, for instance.
Right. It was a nice surprise.
Charles Wolforth, what can I say? What can you say? Do you have anything to say? You got like 15 seconds.
I'm really glad you're doing this show, and I think that we need to do more 20th anniversary observances. These emotions are still too raw, and there's still way too much that we need to talk about.
All right. Our apologies to all the people who called and did not get through. Hopefully someone said on the show some of the thoughts that were going through your mind, and clearly we need to come back to this, and we will on next Tuesday, which will be the anniversary of the spill. Pat Yak joined the crew today on the phones, Len Anderson also on the phones, and on the controls. Thank you so much, Dave. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo goes the distance for the Iditarod, an event that brings people together in the spirit of Alaska's heritage. Wells Fargo, the next stage. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.